Hello and welcome to the PCOS Nutritionist Podcast. If we haven't met yet, then my name today is Selma from The Simpsons because I have come down with a sore throat and apparently lost my voice. So I'm sorry about that. You're going to have to listen to my husky, gravelly, sounds like I've smoked 20 packets of durries in the last day voice today. But in all seriousness, if you are new here, we haven't met yet, then my name is Claire. I'm a registered nutritionist, background in exercise science and natural fertility education. And I specialise solely in PCOS because I know how frustrating it is because I've been there too. And I know what it's like to not get the answers that you need and not really even be told what PCOS is or be told really general, broad sweeping things like, oh, you've got PCOS, therefore you're going to struggle to conceive, which is what I got told when I was first diagnosed. And it's taken me many years of research to figure out that that is not necessarily true. Actually, women with PCOS have no less children than women without PCOS. That is a fact, right? That is direct from the literature to your ears, and I really want you to know that. And that is one of my main reasons for writing my book, which is out today. It's so exciting. So this is Getting Pregnant with PCOS, and you can find that on all Amazon stores, so both as a Kindle version and then also as a paperback version. And this is also probably coincidentally why I have lost my voice, because it turns out that doing a book launch in the middle of a global pandemic is not so easy, and there are so many things that go wrong from your book printer going into lockdown and not being able to actually get into work to physically print your book, to the lack of freight that's going around in the world at the moment, and therefore all freight being disrupted and taking way longer to get to certain countries. And it turns out that this can be quite stressful and lead to a lot of late nights and therefore be the perfect environment to develop a cold from. So on that note, if you are in Australia or New Zealand, the paperback version of the book has been delayed getting to us. That's okay. In Australia, it should be there in the next week or so. In New Zealand, we will definitely have it for you, hopefully before Christmas. I'm hoping that it'll get here. It's due to arrive mid-December and we'll send those books out. So you'll be able to do a pre-order on our website for them because we want you to be able to get the books. We'll get, you know, get it without having to pay massive international shipping costs from, say, the US or UK. So if you're in New Zealand and looking for a paperback copy, then go to our website, thepcosnutritionist.com/book, and you can then pre-order a copy there. If you're in Australia, hang fire for about a week or so and it will be on Amazon. But if you want the Kindle version, just go to your local Amazon store, whatever you normally use to buy your Kindle books, and the Kindle version is available from today. And if you're in the US, UK, Canada, etc., the paperback version is also available from today. Ironic, I know, given that I live in New Zealand and you guys in the US, UK, etc. can get it, but we can't get it here yet. But anyway, it's been a very good lesson to me in just letting things go that you cannot control. I think that if anything that we take from this year is that there are some things which are just purely out of your control. And if you worry about them, you're only going to put yourself in a bit of a spiral of stress when you can't control anything. You can't force your printer to go into work and print the books. You can't force shipping to take a month quicker than what they've said, or there'll be more boats on the water. There's nothing you can do about it. You just have to learn to just go, okay, well, you know what? No one's going to die. It's going to be okay. And I think that, you know, this is my personal experience, but I'm sure that for many of you, you will have had a similar kind of experience where something will happen in your work. Maybe it's that you work in marketing and you're supposed to be doing a massive TV campaign and you can't shoot because you can't get talent because everyone's in isolation. You can't, or you can't get a studio because it's in lockdown, or you were supposed to be running an event and you can't do that anymore. Or it's that you were supposed to be going to meetings offshore, going to conferences, presenting at conferences, and they're not happening anymore. So I think it's just a good lesson for all of us that we just have to let a lot of this stuff go. And this is actually a really big component of the book, where I talk about the different root causes and how they can affect your PCOS symptoms, including fertility. Talk a lot about how stress can as well. And this shows up really often in the scientific research as well, in terms of how stress affects our cycles. And when I asked you guys about your cycles over COVID, 75% of you said that they'd been irregular. Either you'd had long cycles or short cycles, or you'd had irregular bleeding even when you were on hormonal birth control. And this is just a fact of what your body is, how your body is reacting to that, is saying, okay, hang on a minute here. We're under chronic stress. I don't think this is a good time to bring a baby into this world. And so we're not going to ovulate, or we're going to have a really short luteal phase so that you can't get pregnant. Or there are other ways that, and this is an evolutionary aspect or evolutionary advantage for us, is because our body can recognize stress and very quickly adapt our ovulation and cycle patterns to protect us. Because, you know, back thousands of years ago, it wasn't, when, you know, famine and other kind of real life-threatening stresses were very prevalent, it certainly was not advantageous to be pregnant in those environments. And our body is always there protecting ourselves, because after a while, reproduction is very instinctive. Survival is far more instinctive, right? Our body wants to make sure that we survive first and foremost before we reproduce. So we do talk about that there. And what the analogy that I give is what's called the stress bucket. So this is the way that I think about it, is that we can only put so much in our stress bucket. A little bit of stress is actually quite a good thing. I mean, there's no way that I would have got this book finished had I not had the, not stress, but pressure from my publisher to be like, to, you know, meet deadlines. And that creates a little bit of stress, but it's a good thing. It's productive. So think about it like if you've got a bucket, if you have a completely empty bucket, then it could just blow away in the wind. Whereas a little bit of water in there, filling it up a little bit, you know, a quarter full, half full, is actually quite a good thing. The problem is, though, when it is overflowing, right? That's when the bucket is also going to tip over. So we kind of, it's sort of that Goldilocks phenomenon. Not too little, not too much, we want just enough. And when we think about what is too much is when we're continually pouring stresses into that bucket. So, and sometimes when we have to actually take a stock and step back and go, right, well, there's something new that's happened in my life. There's a pandemic that I've never been through before. I've never had these emotions or these stresses of being completely isolated from friends and family and work colleagues. Maybe that's you've got young children that you're looking after, or maybe that it's that your parents are elderly and you're worried about them. Maybe it's that you're in a real hotspot for COVID and you have a chronic health condition, autoimmune disease, and you're really worried about getting COVID yourself. And so if your bucket's already full, then maybe you haven't really taken away enough to manage that, and you're going to, that stress bucket is therefore likely to overflow. And that's when we tend to get symptoms of irregular periods, missing periods, or maybe for you it's something different. Maybe it's sleeping issues. And I know a lot of people have also had massive sleeping issues during COVID. So that is one of the areas that I talk about a lot in the book, and I've therefore had to take some of my own medicine there, my own advice, and go, right, it's time to step back a bit, Claire. You can't control that. You actually just need to focus on what you can control, because you are only going to make yourself sick, which has happened. And also, you're only just going to get yourself frustrated when you actually can't do anything about it. There's no benefit of that stress. It's not like the stress of actually, as I said, that deadline, of meeting that deadline, because that I was in control of that. It was down to me in terms of how many words I wrote per day. But when it comes to printing, shipping, etc., entirely out of my control. I'm hardly going to get my laser inkjet HP printer out and print 5,000 copies of the book myself, am I? So maybe the same thing goes for you in your work or whatever else is happening in your life at the moment. So that was a little bit of a side note, but it weaves into quite well what we were talking about today, which is what actually do I cover in this book on getting pregnant with PCOS, and into a bit of a deep dive into the medical treatments for PCOS, because there is a lot of research on what's best, what doesn't work as well, and how you can make some of those fertility treatments better. So firstly, what do we actually go through in the book? So the book is broken up into three parts: understanding PCOS and how it affects fertility, then my five-step plan for a healthy pregnancy, child, and you, and then lastly, troubleshooting. So firstly, what we go through is understanding PCOS and how it affects fertility. So we go through, first chapter is, what is PCOS? Because if you're anything like me, when I got diagnosed with PCOS, I really didn't get told much. I just got told that I had these cysts on my ovaries and I had this high testosterone, which was a symptom for me. I know it's not the same for everybody. And really, the only other thing I got told was when I asked, well, what does it mean? They said, well, you're likely going to struggle to conceive. Well, they said, you will struggle to conceive. And then the second thing was said was, you will also struggle to lose weight. So with no other kind of context. And this is why I wanted to go into what is PCOS? Because PCOS does not make you infertile. Okay? Let me say that again. PCOS does not make you infertile. PCOS can affect fertility, but in ways that are reversible and fixable. So really what it's doing is that what all PCOS is, it's a hormone imbalance that may be stopping you from ovulating or maybe affecting your egg quality or making your luteal phase, the second part of your cycle, too short to allow you to actually, for that embryo, even if it has, you know, egg and sperm have met, to allow that to actually implant. Or maybe it's making your cycle so irregular, you don't know when your fertile phase, your cycle is, and you can't conceive because you don't know when you should be having intercourse. So these are all things that can be addressed. And this is why I wanted to write this book, because so much of this can be fixed and so much of it is within your control. So that's the first part of the chapter. The second chapter delves into the actual hormone imbalances in PCOS. What's going on in PCOS that affects things like ovulation? And maybe those hormones are affecting also egg quality. And to give you an understanding about what a normal cycle looks like and then what a PCOS typical cycle can look like. And just how I use the example of, it's like a football team that's just a bit out of sync, right? They're just a bit out of practice and they're just not working well together as a team. And that's similar to your hormones. They're just not working quite right as a team. It doesn't mean they never will. It just means that that's at the moment. And that's why I think that when women get told things like, oh, you'll struggle to conceive, it should be given with the context of, hey, this is what's happening at the moment inside your body. Maybe you're not ovulating at the moment. That's not always going to be the way. You can start to ovulate again. If we just kind of address that root cause and fix some of the underlying issues, you can ovulate. It doesn't mean that you never will ovulate again in your life. So that's the kind of context that you get in that chapter. Then chapter 3, spend an entire chapter on why you shouldn't focus on weight loss. Now, this is something that I hear all the time, women getting, you know, denied fertility treatment or told that they won't get fertility treatment or told that they just need to go away and lose weight and there's nothing else that can be done for them. And this is incredibly harmful. I think this is one of the most damaging thing. And it's just it's a reflection of a complete misunderstanding about weight gain and PCOS. So in that chapter, I go through all of the research about why actually the focus shouldn't be on weight loss. Instead, it should be addressing the root cause. And often that root cause can lead to weight gain. But if we just focus on calories, how we're really very unlikely to achieve the outcome of getting you back ovulating or improving your fertility. Chapter 4, we dive into the conventional medical treatments. This is what I'll deep dive into today. What's available to you? So don't get me wrong. You do not have to do this all, quote unquote, naturally, right? Like, this is what I want you to understand, is that there are some brilliant medical treatments out there, but they are also not the only thing. Much of the time when you go through a conventional doctor system, fertility center system, they will explain to you, okay, well, this is what we're going to do for you. We're going to, you know, put you on hormonal birth control until you're ready to conceive. Then when you are, come off that, and then we'll give you some medication to help you ovulate and help you conceive after that. That is not the only way you can do it, right? You do not have for your medication to conceive with PCOS. Some people it can be really helpful, but most people I see is not necessary or even the only option. And I think this is a complete disregard for women's choice in the matter and what, or couples' choice and what you want to do. So what I want to outline in this chapter is what is available to you though, because often you might go through and you want to, you know, you want to try and get your body back ovulating and you are, and but there's just something that's not quite working. Maybe also it's that your partner's sperm isn't actually viable. It's, there's, you know, both, or maybe it's them that is the issue and therefore you may need IVF or something. And so we go through all of the different options available to you. And then I spend a chapter talking about kind of the downsides of that approach of just saying to you, right, well, we'll just, you know, put you onto this drug and make you ovulate. Is what are the actual risks associated with that? So that you can make a fully informed consent in this whole process. you know what the pros and cons are. You know what the success rate is for different medications. You're not then left just going onto Facebook groups and saying, who's had success with Clomid, or tell me about IVF or what you had to do with it. You actually know what the actual success rate is and what can make it more successful. Maybe that there's other more effective drugs in PCOS, and what are some of the risks that you're signing up for, and what are the alternatives? So in terms of when we're looking at success rates, okay, what else can be successful, and what options are there? Because as I said, I think that the approach of just saying to you, right, well, this is the drug, is if you listen to the podcast that we did last week with Helena, she was like, I went through a round of fertility treatment of letrozole, I think it was, and I hated it. And also too, I just didn't have the time. I was a busy lawyer. I was in and out of court. I didn't have time to be going to different fertility appointments and getting, you know, an ultrasound to check how my follicle was developing. And I felt like awful. I felt like hot trash doing it because I was being pumped full of hormones and I just didn't want to do that anymore. And so I think that respect needs to be given for people who do not want to go down that path. And that's what I want you to understand, is what are the other effective treatments that you can use that maybe not a conventional fertility center would talk to you about. So then then it's also too why I think even when we do, you know, if someone does want to go down a treatment of medication or IVF, what can they do alongside that to not just help them get pregnant, but actually my goal is for you to have a healthy pregnancy so that you're healthy and the baby's healthy as well. So I think there's a lot of emphasis put on in the current fertility model in just getting you pregnant with almost zero regard for your health long term during that. And this is evidenced by very rarely would, when you're going through fertility treatment, even though it's so well known that up to 80% of women with PCOS have some insulin issues, it's very, very, very uncommon to actually find that women, when they're going through fertility treatment, would have had some testing like that done to understand a bit about what their insulin is actually doing, and therefore are they going to be at risk of gestational diabetes, and before they get pregnant do we maybe need to try and bring down their insulin, which will then, you know, help them get pregnant but also help them be healthier during their pregnancy and not develop gestational diabetes. So that's the other kind of part of the of that chapter 5, the downside of the current medical approach, is that I think that we really need to be addressing that root cause of why their hormones are out of balance at the same time as using some of those more conventional fertility treatments. It doesn't have to be either or, but I really think it needs to be at the same time. So then, well, you know, what is that root cause and how can you can address it? And that's what my 5-step plan for a healthy pregnancy, child and you is. That's the second part of the book. So chapter 6 is all about identifying your root cause. Okay, and this is what I talk about all the time on this podcast. You know, if it is that your insulin is too high, you know, that is one thing. Insulin resistance, 80% of us have it with PCOS. And that is one of the things when we talk about in the first chapter and second chapter, the hormonal imbalance in PCOS, is looking at, well, is insulin causing that hormonal imbalance? And if we can bring insulin down, could we maybe change the hormonal imbalance, get that football team working together again, and therefore get you ovulating again? And then once we've addressed that root cause, then going into the steps to actually reverse that. So addressing your diet to help to improve that root cause. Then addressing things like stress, which I just mentioned before in terms of the stress bucket. And stress encompasses so many different aspects. It encompasses, as I said, that stress of what's in your stress bucket, but also like sleeping too little, also exercising too much or too little. There are so many parts to that play when it comes to your stress. Then the next chapter in my 5-step plan, so that's the, you know, that is the, was the third step. The fourth step is learning how to chart your cycles and time sex accordingly. So this is one part that I see most women not getting any information about, and I've been posting this on Instagram lately, is so many women not understanding when they're actually fertile in their cycle and using things like ovulation test strips that to measure the hormone, luteinizing hormone in their cycle, to see whether that's high and therefore whether they're fertile. that most women with PCOS have too much luteinizing hormone, or the ratio is too high in their body, and therefore they're getting false positives or just negatives, or it's not actually accurate. So learning how to use your own body signs and symptoms to identify when you're fertile in your cycle, and that chapter goes in depth into how to do that. And then step five in that, in the five-step plan, is getting the nutrients and herbs that you need to help both address your root cause and also set you up so that you have the nutrients that you need to have a healthy pregnancy, child, and you. Because so much emphasis goes into things like preventing neural tube defects, for good reason. I mean, we've shown that supplementing with folate can have a massive impact in reducing the incidence of things like spina bifida. But very little attention is paid to your health, and do you have enough nutrients? Because in the nicest possible way, a baby is the largest and cutest parasite you'll ever have in your body. The definition of parasite is that it will prioritize its own needs over the host. And that is what a baby will do, is it will take what it needs and you'll get left with what's left over. So for example, if you have low iron going into pregnancy, then the baby will take everything that it needs, but you'll be left anemic. Same thing with, you know, folate and B12. The baby will take what it needs to develop its neural tube, but you'll be left with what is left over, and often that is severe deficiency. And this can lead to a whole raft of complications post-pregnancy, in terms of just from you feeling utterly exhausted to potentially contributing to things like postnatal depression and mood disorders, sleep disorders postnatally as well. Not that you needed any more of those when you've got a screaming infant, but so many of the things that are put down to just, you know, postpartum are not actually, they're actually, you know, really severe deficiencies in micronutrients. And it's been really clear in the research that most pregnant women do not get anywhere near what they need from their diet when it comes to during pregnancy. So that is a whole chapter just on the supplementation part. So supplementing for your type, and then also supplementing for your, for pregnancy. The other thing that we do go into is sperm parameters. So what are the optimal sperm parameters for your partner or for your donor? And these are quite different to what if the male goes and gets a sperm test from the doctor. Often they'll just get told, yes, everything's normal. But what's actually normal can be quite different to what's optimal. So I go into what the current research is saying is actually optimal. And then if it's not, which is most of the case, I would say that I've actually looked through the data on this on my patient base, but I would say 75 to 80% of the time, one or more of the male sperm parameters are not optimal. And so we'd have to do with some work there as well. And so I actually write a chapter for your partner or donor on this, because I don't want you having to relay this information to them. I want them, because no one likes being told what to do, right? So I want them to read and understand what it means and what they can do to improve their sperm quality. And then the final section is troubleshooting. So this is if you've gone through all of those steps and you're still not pregnant, what are the other things that could be going on? So could it be something like endometriosis as well as PCOS? Because 10% of women suffer from endometriosis. And so it's really, 10% of women with PCOS also have endometriosis. Also, many people have a deficiency or a genetic defect with some genes that can contribute to things like infertility. So we go through all those. There's also those that can contribute to complications. So, miscarriage, recurrent miscarriage, preeclampsia, those kind of pregnancy complications as well. And so that's what we go through in chapter 12, is reducing your risk during pregnancy. So women with PCOS, people with PCOS are much more likely to develop gestational diabetes. They're more likely to develop preeclampsia. So I go through all the research in there and help you understand how you can potentially reduce your risk during pregnancy. Again, my goal for you is not just to get pregnant, but to have a healthy pregnancy, child, and you. And then lastly, the last chapter is, I call this protecting your fertility. So this is for, well, the whole book really is for those of you where maybe fertility is not a goal for you at the moment, but you want to know more about it and you want that to be a goal for you in the future. Or maybe you're just using it as a way of kind of a scorecard for your body, because if you're ovulating, that's a really good sign that things are working pretty well inside your body, that hormonally you're good. Whereas if you're not ovulating or your cycles are really long, it's also a good sign that something's a little bit off. So in protecting your fertility, it goes through why, how you can use this book to understand and what you can do now, right? Because I think this is a massive myth as well, that you can't do anything until you start trying. So it's one of these awkward situations where you're like, oh, I want to, but I'm not ready for that yet, but I want to know that that's an option for me. And I would say that that is a massive myth, that you can't do anything until you start trying. There is so much that you can do to understand more about your fertility and improve your fertility without trying at all. So without having a partner, without having unprotected sex, without getting pregnant, there is so much that you can understand about your body and your fertility before you start trying, years in advance. So that's it. That is what we cover in the book. And I hope I know that it will answer so many questions, because as I said, I've been where you are now. I've been told that fertility will be a problem for me. I've, you know, been on your side where I've just been seeing screeds of women on Facebook groups talking about fertility troubles and thinking, well, that's going to be my lot. And then to be now on the other side of actually understanding the physiology of how fertility works, so what you actually need, and this is what I talk about in the book, is your fertile ingredients, and how when you strip it back to those really core fertile ingredients, how you can really understand how different parts of PCOS might be affecting those fertile ingredients at the moment, but it doesn't need to mean that that's always the case, and they can be improved, and whether that's, you know, naturally or whether that's using medical treatments, but that they are all reversible and fixable, as opposed to, you know, you kind of missing sexual organs which can't really be replaced or worked around. So the book, as my publisher said to me, she said, it's a very meaty book, in reference to the fact that it is 337 pages and it has a shit ton of references. There are so many references with every chapter, and that's down to my commitment to you guys to bring you evidence-based information and the latest research, so that not just on the kind of lifestyle treatments PCOS, but also the conventional medical treatments as well. So I am really confident that there will be a lot that you get out of this book that you don't already know. I think that, I mean, I learned so much myself writing this book. So I think it's not one of those ones where you go like, oh, am I really going to learn anything, or is this going to be really general information that I could get out of a PCOS Facebook group? No, it is not. I'm very confident in that. Now, to give you a little bit of an inside scoop into more of the detail in terms of the book, I thought I'd go into one of the chapters, which was around the conventional medical treatments for fertility challenges in PCOS. We're very lucky that there are many amazing medical treatments to help with fertility in PCOS. And I love that we can combine the best of kind of lifestyle-based medicine and then the traditional kind of medical medicine to help us conceive. However, I do see that in most cases, it's very common just to jump to the conventional drugs and surgery model for fertility, when actually lifestyle could have done the same job, if not better, and at a lower risk. And the new evidence-based international guidelines for the management of PCOS are really specific with this. They're, you know, they state that holistic approaches are required, and pharmacological therapy in PCOS needs to be considered alongside education, lifestyle, and other options, which can include things like changing your diet and exercise and supplementing and things like that. So, but the problem is the reason why your doctor might not be giving you this information is because they just don't have it themselves. This isn't something that they are taught at medical school or, you know, post and in training, is because, you know, the model that they operate in is really the diagnose and then treatment, which treatments involve is surgery and drugs, really, is what it comes down to. So I think that it is brilliant that we can kind of combine the both, but it might be that you're not getting all the alternative options. And even a lot of the cases, the really informed consent and knowing what you're signing up to when you are taking those treatments as well. And so that's why we'll go into that later in the book. But in this chapter, it's really about the different conventional medical treatments available and how they work and what kind of is more effective and what's not. So the first really common one is called clomiphene, and it's also called clomiphene citrate, or marketed under the names Clomid or Seraphine as well. So it's the most common fertility medication for PCOS, and the way that it works is by artificially stimulating your body to ovulate. So it really, it takes over the ovulation process. The way it does it is it blocks the receptors in your brain for estrogen. So it makes your body think that estrogen is low, and that leads your body to, you know, produce more estrogen and also more follicle stimulating hormone, which is what, so follicle stimulating hormone is actually what grows those little baby eggs inside your ovaries into the large eggs that you can then ovulate. They're not really clear how that 100% how it works in PCOS, but it's likely that that increase in follicle stimulating hormone improves our ratio of LH and FSH. And going through the book, I explain all these terms, and you get used to all of these terms. But those are the two hormones that are really involved in ovulation. So, and what happens in PCOS hormonally is that often LH is too high, or the ratio is out between the two. And so by increasing that FSH, it's likely that the ratio no longer looks too high, and therefore your body can now ovulate. So after about the last dose of clomiphene that they give you, ovulation will occur, and a surge of luteinizing hormone from your brain stimulates your egg to develop and mature and therefore be released. So clomiphene can be really helpful for women who aren't ovulating. But unfortunately, the success rate isn't particularly high in PCOS, and only 22% of women have a live birth after 6 cycles of clomiphene. Now, one of the reasons that this might be is because of one of the downsides of clomiphene, and that is that it can thin your uterine lining, or think about that as like the nest where your egg develops in. So the success rate, interestingly, can be increased by combining clomiphene with improving your insulin. Now, that can be done through either, you know, a drug like metformin, or using natural treatments to bring down your insulin, like changing your diet and the way that you live and supplements and stuff like that. So that is that's a really, really important thing to understand, is that you can actually improve that success rate by addressing lifestyle at the same time. But other thing I just really want to point out is that clomiphene is successful for people who aren't already ovulating. It's not actually that successful in people that already are ovulating. And this is what I see in so many people with PCOS, is they have been, you know, they might have a 35 or 40 or 50 or 60 day cycle, but they're still actually ovulating. But they'll be given, when they go as, you know, sort of the first line of treatment, they'll go to their doctor and say, hey, look, we're trying to conceive. And they'll just be given clomiphene or another drug, which we'll talk about in a minute. But no one actually is sitting down and working out, well, let's just see what actually is going on here. Are you actually ovulating? So the research shows that if you are already ovulating, taking clomiphene does not increase your chance of getting pregnant. So, and that makes sense, because it doesn't make sense to be taking a drug that affects your hormones, can thin your uterine lining, let alone the cost of the drug, and also the effect that it's having on your body. And that's what Helena was saying about the fertility drug, is that that's not what no one tells you, is that actually how it's going to make you feel, and the not just the cost in terms of monetary outlay, but the time outlay of going through all of these fertility treatments, is that she's like, I'm just not up for that. I don't want to do that. And so unfortunately, many women I see haven't been checked about what actually the problem is before being prescribed clomiphene. This is what I really recommend, is getting a basic fertility workup done for you and your partner, because it might be that you go in, your doctor looks up and says, right, this is a standard operating procedure for someone with PCOS, is that we try you first on one of these ovulation drugs like clomiphene, or maybe it's letrozole, which we'll talk about in a minute. And then, but actually the problem isn't with you. You are already ovulating. The problem is actually with your partner, but no one's even checked them yet, because they just automatically go, okay, well, you've got PCOS, therefore the problem's with you, when that's maybe not the case at all. Or maybe the case is not that you're not ovulating, but it's just that your luteal phase is too short, or there's some other kind of issue. So that's why I really recommend getting a basic fertility workup done to check that that's actually what's going on. So the actual treatment process, this is something that you can go through in the book, in terms of how actually, what is the process? So we go through from, day one, your doctor or fertility specialist will tell you to contact the clinic on the first day of your period. If you aren't getting cycles, you will likely be given a progesterone, so like medoxyprogesterone, also known as Provera, to kind of stimulate a period for, might be given for 10 days or something like that, and stimulate the period. And then I go through what to expect on day 2, 3, day 3, 5, 8 to 17, all the way through for the full procedure. One thing I really would recommend, if you are taking a ovulation stimulating drug like clomiphene or letrozole, is that you are getting those cycles monitored. Now, this can sometimes be an optional add-on, but I would highly recommend it. So what a monitored cycle is when they will give you the drug, and then they will get you to come in and check how that follicle or baby egg is actually growing and developing, and if you are going to ovulate, or whether your body has actually produced 3 eggs. So the reason for this is so important is that we don't all respond to the same amount of the drug that they give you. So it's a bit of trial and error in terms of how much drug you need to ovulate, and to ovulate only 1 egg as opposed to, say, 3 eggs or 5 eggs. So, for example, I had a case of this week where one of the women I work with in the PCOS protocol told me on our Q&A, our Zoom call on Monday, that they gave her a dose of clomiphene, and she went in and got the ultrasound done to monitor cycles, and she'd actually produced 3 eggs. And so the risk of this is, if they had intercourse then, she would likely end up with triplets. And that is not a particularly desirable outcome, because multiple births are very, very high risk, both for you and the baby. So they were told, don't have intercourse this cycle, and then we'll go back next time and we'll just reduce the dose down. So what happened next time is they reduced the dose down, but it was reduced it too much for her, and she didn't ovulate at all, didn't produce any follicle. So now in the third cycle, they've increased that slightly more, and then she did produce 1 egg this cycle. Right, so it's kind of like the Goldilocks phenomenon. It's the not too little, not too much, it just needs to be just enough. And that is dependent on you, right? There's a lot of factors that go into how much, and it is just trial and error. And so if you are not getting a monitored cycle, you won't know whether you are not ovulating at all. So, for example, they might give you, I don't know, this is just off the top of my head, but they might give you something like 10 milligrams. These are not actual numbers, so don't think, oh my gosh, my doctor's only giving me 1 milligram. This is just, just me off the top of my head. So they might give you 10 milligrams and you don't get pregnant. But if you're not getting a monitored cycle, you wouldn't know whether actually that's just because you have actually ovulated, but you just didn't get pregnant, because even when you do ovulate, you still only got about 10 to 15% chance of actually getting pregnant on that cycle. And that is dependent on your age, what that percentage would be. As you're younger, the percentage is higher. As you get older, the percentage gets lower. And that all comes down to things like egg quality and chromosomal abnormalities and things like that. So you wouldn't know, if you weren't getting a monitored cycle, you wouldn't know whether that is just because you haven't ovulated at all and therefore you need a slightly higher dose, or whether it's because you have ovulated but you just didn't conceive on that cycle. So you might go through your 6 rounds of Clomid and never actually ovulate because they haven't given you enough. Or you might get multiple births, which can be then quite risky, and and can lead to a lot more complications, which is not desirable. So I really would recommend asking for a monitored cycle. And this might be something that you need to negotiate with your facilitator provider, and it might come with extra costs and things like that. And I understand that not everyone can afford that. That's okay, but it's worthwhile having that conversation to understand. And unless you understand like the risks and the pros and cons, how can you make an informed decision about whether, you know, it's you want to do that? Especially like in this case, in this another woman that we were talking to on the same Zoom call this week, she was, when I said to her, are you getting a monitored cycle? She had no idea what that was. So she'd never been offered it as an option. So I would really recommend that you talk to your fertility provider. If they haven't talked to you about a monitored cycle, ask them and say, hey, what's going on here? What is, you know, can I get a monitored cycle? If they don't do monitored cycles at all, that's slightly concerning, right? It might be that you then try and seek out an alternative provider. But generally they should offer that as at least a service. With another woman who I was talking to on our PCOS protocol Zoom call a few weeks ago, she'd only ever been given, I think it was 50 milligrams of clomiphene, whereas actually some women need up to 150 milligrams of clomiphene before their eggs start to grow properly. So just, and that, you know, that likely was the case for her as well. She's going back and talking to her facility provider about that at the moment. But you'd never know unless kind of they're doing a monitored cycle to see what's going on. So as I mentioned before, clomiphene works more effectively if your insulin is lower. So remember, I talk about insulin all the time. It's your hormone that controls your blood glucose. And when insulin is high, it has a range of effects in your body and in PCOS. And this is what's going on for most women with PCOS. So if you haven't kind of, if you're in mid-cycle clomiphene and you haven't worked out yet if, you know, you've got too high insulin, or maybe you've even gone and done a test like an HbA1c or a fasting blood glucose, I would say to you that those are awful tests for picking up early stage insulin resistance. So you do likely have some insulin resistance, even if those tests are showing as normal. I would, you know, if you're mid-stage and those clomiphene cycles haven't been working for you, it might even be worthwhile putting those on hold and going away, trying to understand what your root cause is and addressing that, especially if it is insulin, bring that down before you go on. And the reason for that is that the maximum number of rounds of clomiphene they'll give you in most countries is 6. And for a woman over the age of 38, it's just 3. So that's because clomiphene can overstimulate your ovaries, causing something called ovarian hyperstimulation. And oh my god, actually so funny, because on our Q&A this week on our Zoom call for the PCOS protocol, we had another woman who had that. Hers was actually, they were doing an egg retrieval. She was doing some egg freezing, and they had she wound up in the ER department, emergency department, during COVID because she had been hyperstimulated. And this is a life-threatening condition. Basically, it causes fluid in your abdomen, which can be life-threatening. And so that is why they will only give you a certain amount of rounds. And so clomiphene resistance is what it's called when you don't conceive within those maximum number of cycles permitted. And generally, it's, in my experience, is due to your insulin or androgen levels being too high. And it affects about a quarter of women with PCOS. They'll go through clomiphene and then be told, no, you're clomid resistant. But just letting you know that even if you have been told that, not all is lost. It is possible to conceive naturally or through other methods as well. And one really good example of this is a woman called Sarah. She is on my YouTube channel. I did a case study with her because when I first met her, so Sarah, she'd been an athlete her entire life, competing in like lacrosse and cross country at high school. As you can tell, she's from the US because she plays lacrosse. But in her later high school years, she found that she was like gaining weight and her periods had disappeared. And her doctor put this down to the fact that she was training heavily and advised her to go on hormonal birth control to regulate her periods. Just didn't really sit well with Sarah though. Wasn't that normal. And even when, you know, she was on hormonal birth control, her weight was still increasing as well. So when I met her after she had
come off hormonal birth control after, because she was getting married, and she had other symptoms like acne and fatigue, and she'd been diagnosed with PCOS, but she hadn't really been told a lot. She felt incredibly lost. They had no real treatment plan for her. All they could say to her was, "We'll just go back on to hormonal birth control, and then when you want kids, we'll just give you metformin and clomiphene to help you conceive." So after she got married in 2015, they started trying to conceive. She went through, they tried for 2 years, and then she went through 6 rounds of Clomid without success, and was then told IVF is your only option. She tried all sorts of things, herbs and acupuncture and loads of other natural treatments as well, but nothing kind of resonated. Her mum actually saw an article that I did in Woman's Day, of all things. Or maybe it was her mother-in-law, because her mum's in the US. Her mother-in-law in the UK saw an article I did for Woman's Day in the UK and was like, "You should contact this woman." And so I met her in 2017. And then when I did kind of my normal workup that I do in terms of root cause analysis, we figured out that her insulin and stress hormones were a little bit too high, and that's why she likely wasn't ovulating naturally. And also probably why the clomiphene didn't work. So we set about addressing her insulin, bringing that down, bringing down her stress hormones as well. So things like, instead of running like 8 miles a day, she switched to like some weight training and some yoga and walking, and just trying to bring her stress hormones down. She's a teacher, so like stress is quite high. And the results from that were astounding. So within a month, her cycles had returned. So she hadn't had a period in, I don't know how many years, naturally. So cycles returned in 1 month, and within 4 months, she was pregnant completely naturally. And that's given the fact that she had been told, "You're Clomid resistant, the only option for you is IVF." And so that's what I want you guys to understand, is that often you'll be told it's because the only option of you can't go through any more rounds of Clomid because it's too dangerous because of ovarian hyperstimulation. But it doesn't mean that is IVF is your only option. It's just whatever your doctor has in their kit bag to give you, which was, for her, other kind of fertility, more kind of conventional fertility treatments. And it was so funny. Actually, I was just messaging Sarah on Instagram a couple of months ago, because I was asking her whether I could use the case study in the book. And she was like, "Oh, great timing. We're actually just got pregnant with our second baby, all completely naturally as well." So brilliant news. And you know, I think that it's just so good to see examples of women who have been told, "No, this is your only option." And for her, for Sarah and her husband, they're both teachers. In the UK, they have this thing called the IVF postcode lottery. So pretty much it depends on where you live, where the IVF is funded for you in that area, or whether you have to be on a waiting list. And they were unlucky in the IVF postcode lottery, and it wasn't funded for them. So, you know, that wasn't really an option for them. So I think that it is so important for everyone to hear that that's not necessarily the case. There are other options in most cases. So that is Clomid. But what I also want to say, and I'm going to skip ahead now, is that there's a less known fertility drug. Its trade name is Femara. It's also known as letrozole. And the evidence, the research is showing that it may be much better than clomiphene for people with PCOS and stimulating ovulation. So the current guidelines for PCOS is that letrozole should be the first choice in fertility treatment over clomiphene. So if your fertility doctor is recommending clomiphene, they're not up with the most recent research on this. They should be recommending letrozole or Femara for you if you have PCOS. So interesting when it comes to letrozole. Letrozole wasn't actually designed as a fertility drug. It was actually developed to treat postmenopausal breast cancer, which was interesting. But what happened was they found that it triggered ovulation, and you know, if used in the same way as clomiphene. So it works in a very similar way to clomiphene, in that it blocks that estrogen receptor in your brain as well. So it tricks your body into thinking your estrogen is low, so you produce more follicle stimulating hormone to grow that egg and hopefully ovulate. So when they've looked at the effectiveness of letrozole, and they did a big analysis of all of the randomized control trials of the drugs. And so I think there was about over 2,000 women with PCOS. And that found that letrozole resulted in significantly more women ovulating compared with clomiphene, which is where we get that recommendation from, that letrozole is more effective than clomiphene. But like clomiphene, if you're already ovulating, then letrozole probably won't increase your chance of getting pregnant. So I really would recommend, again, getting that fertility workup to understand what the actual problem is. So is it that you're not ovulating? Is it that you are ovulating, but you're just ovulating really late in your cycle and therefore your luteal phase is really short? Is it that your partner's sperm is the problem? Or is it that you have some blocked tubes and the sperm can't actually get through to meet your little egg? Doing that first can be super helpful to really understand what the problem is and put you on the right treatment path, as opposed to putting you through six rounds of clomiphene or letrozole, which weren't going to work anyway because your partner's sperm's not optimal. And, you know, as I said, these come with no risks. I outline the risks in the book. And also too, it's not that they come without any effect on you. Anyone that's been through fertility treatment will tell you that most people feel awful. They feel super bloated and maybe really moody and sometimes nauseous. And so it does have an impact on your quality of life, your ability to do your job, your ability to sleep properly, have fun, enjoy. And, you know, it can affect a lot of social things. It can also affect your day-to-day life because you might be having to take trips to the fertility center, and therefore that might impact your work and other social life and other things as well. And especially for those at the moment with general COVID outbreaks, it might also be exposing you to additional risks in terms of having to go out and go to clinics where you might encounter other people with COVID-19. So that's all we're going to go to for today. This is a tiny segment of the chapter on the conventional medical treatments for PCOS, but I hope that gives you a bit of an insight into what we look at, the depth that we go into, and how these treatments actually work, and what ones would be better for you and what ones wouldn't be, and how we then understand what are the pros and cons and what other alternative options you have available for you. So if you want to get a copy of Getting Pregnant with PCOS, then the links are in the show notes below. You can just go to thepcosnutritionist.com/book, and we'll just hit book from the main menu, and then you'll be able to click through there, which will take you through to where you can order in your country. Or you can just search on Amazon, your local Amazon where you normally buy books from, Getting Pregnant with PCOS, and it will come up there as well. As I said, for anyone in Australia or New Zealand who wants the paperback copy, that will be coming in the next few weeks. So just hang fire. I'll let you know about that. You will, if you're in New Zealand, you will be able to pre-order that. So you can go onto the website and just pre-order the copy and we'll send it out. We're only going to do one shipment pre-Christmas. So, well, fingers crossed we can actually get the book pre-Christmas. It's looking good at the moment, but who knows? All things can happen. But we were doing that one shipment, and then pretty much because a lot of stuff closes down, and we'll be doing a shutdown over Christmas New Year as well. We won't be sending out the next shipment until mid-January. So if you do want to get your hands on the first physical paperback copy here in New Zealand, then make sure you pre-order for that. If you're in Australia, it will be available on Amazon in the next week or so. So just keep your eyes peeled on there for that. So that's it for today. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening to my husky Selma voice. I will be back next week with a fully functioning voice, and we'll be talking all things pelvic floor with the vagina physio, Caitlin. So this is a really relevant podcast for everybody. It's not just about fertility. Pelvic floor is super important for all females, and it is a very female-centric condition because our pelvic floor acts like a hammock for all of our organs, and that's why when it gets stretched and loose, we can have issues like urinary incontinence and bladder or even bowel leakages, and that does get worse post-pregnancy, but it is certainly the case for many women as well, that they may have even before having a baby, outside of that, have issues like urinary incontinence. And she gives us some really amazing insights into what can actually, you know, how you can strengthen that pelvic floor. And it's not just for many women, they are doing pelvic floor exercises, but they're doing them wrong, or their pelvic floor is actually overstimulated and they need to learn how to relax it. So she'll be talking all things there. Really super interesting podcast. So thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll catch you next week. Bye.